Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of the morning Dhamma talk from our one-day retreat at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on April 9th, 2017. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the meaning of right intention in developing emptiness of clinging. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. Thank you. Peace.
So all this week, I've given talks on emptiness, different suttas that the Buddha taught, his meaning of emptiness, in slightly different applications. But it can be truthfully said that the entire Buddha's teachings are designed to allow us to recognize clinging self-referential views and to empty ourselves of those clinging views. And that really is the essence of the Buddha's teachings, to empty ourselves of clinging views that are rooted in ignorance. So another way of saying that is emptiness, as the Buddha taught, is to empty ourselves of that initial ignorance of Four Noble Truths. And this talk is about bringing in the entire Eightfold Path, but very specifically right view and right intention into that theme of emptiness. It is a cultivation of moment-to-moment mindfulness of the Eightfold Path that develops release from clinging and a mind of lasting peace. Release from clinging is the condition that the Buddha described as awakened, or gaining full human maturity, and a mind of lasting peace is the quality of mind of an awakened human being. Throughout the Pali Canon, right intention is described as a cause, a condition, and a quality of mind. As one factor of the Eightfold Path, the Buddha describes right view in conjunction with right intention as the initial understanding and action necessary for the development of the other factors of the path. And how is right view, the Buddha's words, and how is right view the forerunner for further development, meaning the foundation? With right view, one understands wrong intention as wrong intention. Makes sense, doesn't it? And right intention is right intention. Wrong intention is holding the intention for constant sensory fulfillment, for ill will, and being harmful. Right intention is the intention to abandon wrong intention and develop and maintain right intention. That's also called right effort, or the sixth factor, the Eightfold Path. Being mindful to abandon wrong intention and develop and maintain right intention is right mindfulness, the seventh factor of the Eightfold Path. These three qualities of right view, right effort, and right mindfulness inform and support right intention. As this, these are my words, as the second factor of the Eightfold Path, right intention is clearly the cause for the conditioned condition of awakening. Following right view, right intention provides the motivation for right effort and points the mind to right mindfulness, to hold in mind the abandonment of clinging to objects and views. Later developments and accommodations or dismissal to the Eightfold Path to allow for the substitution of the intention of becoming a bodhisattva fail to develop the cause of the condition of awakening. Does everybody understand that bodhisattva? I think I talk about that enough. The vow. The vow of the bodhisattva is to put aside your own awakening until all other sentient beings are awakened. And that's kind of the foundation for the Mahayana schools of Buddhism. On its surface, it sounds like a wonderful ideal and an aspiration. But on just close, not that close examination, just a minor examination, you realize that it's just a futile exercise. And it contradicts the First Noble Truth. The Buddha states that as a consequence of living in the human world is going to be dukkha, and people are going to continue to experience that dukkha unless they individually take to the Dhamma and awaken. There's nothing I can do save for being an example, hopefully, of an awakened human being that can influence other people. We can't force other people to awaken. We can't hope. We can hope with all we want. And I certainly hope that the whole world would awaken, gain full human maturity. But that's probably not going to have much of an effect on anything. It's up to individuals. And that's what the Buddha taught an Eightfold Path for. Going back to the Buddha as an example, here was an awakened human being, probably the most compassionate and wise human being that's ever lived. And yet he couldn't affect awakening for everyone just by hoping that it would happen. And he couldn't hope that it would happen by denying his own awakening. Of course, he didn't do that. He awakened, and then he taught other people how to do it. Whether people want to do it, that's something else again. And that's that. That's the contradiction and the confusion that arises from that bodhisattva vow. I took the vow of the bodhisattva, in the Kagyu lineage, at a time when I was becoming quite confused with that whole idea, but I went ahead and did it anyway because I was associated with a large Buddhist group that's what they did. There was a long, elaborate ceremony over a weekend. A few other things were tied into that, and I took this vow. About 6 months later, and during that 6 months, I was really struggling with why I did this, and is it even reasonable, and where is this taking me? Why am I putting aside my own awakening to do something that I didn't really feel I could accomplish, save all sentient beings? And eventually I came to the realization, this is about the time frame in my studies that I was also now looking at the Buddhist teachings. And it took me a while to realize that this was just a contradictory teaching. And I formally disavowed that. That was an important thing for me to do. And again, I'm not putting down people that decide to take this vow and devote their life to it. It's just not something that the Buddha taught. It has nothing to do with... If you think about the idea of clinging views, once I take this vow, I'm now creating an identity as a savior of the world, aren't I? That even just this simple act of I'm not going to awaken until everybody else is an act of creating a self-identity. And it's a distraction, and it's the opposite of emptying myself of ignorant views. The Buddha consistently described awakening as unbound or released from clinging to objects, views, and events, including the view that by me putting aside my own awakening, somehow other people can awaken. In the Devahapitaka Sutta, the Buddha teaches the assembled monks that without right intention, the intention to recognize and renounce clinging, the mind remains confused and split between an altruistic goal, but lacking the heightened wisdom developed through mindful recognition and renunciation of clinging. I should also point out, when the Buddha talks about himself previously, prior to his awakening, he uses that term bodhisattva, but he describes it as something as preliminary to awakening. He would consistently say, when I was an unawakened bodhisattva, prior to his awakening, what he's saying there is he had all the compassion that he had post-awakening, but he was lacking the wisdom and understanding of how to awaken and how to teach that. He was an unawakened bodhisattva. He had the intention to be helpful to everyone, but he didn't have the means to make that change. And when he awakened, he never set himself up as a savior. He never taught the Four Noble Truths as a salvific path, like most religions are. He simply taught it as a practical way for individual human beings to gain full human maturity, to develop that life, that mind of calm and peace, unbound, or empty of clinging. The Buddha continues, monks, prior to my awakening, when I was an unawakened bodhisattva, I thought I could continue to divide my thinking. I continued thinking intended on sensuality, ill will, and harmfulness, and thinking intended on renunciation, goodwill, and harmlessness. You can see this, the tension. The Buddha's recognizing the tension in his own mind from having these contradictory views, even that view that I can, as an individual, I can save the world. As I remained mindful and well concentrated, thinking with the intention of clinging arose in me. I now recognize that thinking with the intention of clinging has arisen in me. Thinking with the intention of clinging brings suffering for me and others. This thinking can only lead to more ignorance and does not develop unbinding from clinging. As I noticed that wrong intention develops more suffering, wrong intention subsided. What is so interesting to me and what's important about that last sentence is the Buddha didn't now describe, he first is saying that I recognize and acknowledge clinging views in myself. But then he doesn't say, and I went through this long analytical process of examining every single view and every single this and every single that, and I spent years on the therapist's couch going over all these terrible things that happened to me. What he says is, I recognize clinging views, and I abandon them. in a very direct way. That's why he taught the Eightfold Path. I'll read that again. As I noticed that wrong intention develops more suffering, wrong intention subsided. Much like what we do in meditation, isn't it? We recognize that we're caught up in our thoughts. Those are clinging thoughts. We come back to the sensation of breathing. We don't have to get into the thoughts. We don't have to analyze the thoughts. We simply recognize the distraction caused by clinging, come back to the sensation of breathing. Subsequently, when wrong intention arose in me, I simply abandoned it. My words now. Even altruistic intentions can lead to further confusion and suffering, as the Buddha teaches here. If there continues a clinging view lacking wisdom, developing a view of self attached to impermanent concepts must eventually be recognized as founded in wrong intention and abandoned if developing as an awakened human being is to be realized. In the Anguttara Nikaya, the Buddha teaches that being mindful of right intention to awaken will benefit all beings, the Buddha's words. Practicing the Dhamma for one's own benefit and for others is to be praised. But notice the first part of that sentence, for one's own benefit. There's some underlying criticism in the Mahayana schools. There's two extant schools of Buddhism today. There's a Hinayana, which means a lesser vehicle, and the Mahayana, which means a greater vehicle. And I won't get into the whole story, but there was a split that occurred about 450 years after the Buddha's death because a sect called the Mahasanghikas wanted a more visionary and mystical type of Buddhism. And so they split from the original Sangha that was still maintaining the Buddha's original teachings. And that was the foundation for the modern Mahayana schools. So I forget what I was going to... why I brought that up. Oh, so there's a kind of an underlying criticism of the Hinayana school, meaning the original teachings of the Buddha, as being very self-centered and selfish because you're seeking only awakening for yourself rather than that altruistic and grand vision of I'm not going to awaken until everybody else is awakened. But of course, that later developed teaching contradicts the Buddha's teachings, and it contradicts exactly what the Buddha is saying in this sutta here too. Practicing the Dhamma for one's own benefit and for others is to be praised. That's exactly what the Buddha did. The Buddha had this incredible desire to help others and be compassionate. That's why he left his life as a prince in his father's kingdom. He could have lived a life of incredible luxury. But he so wanted to understand the nature of suffering and if there was a way to bring that to cessation. That's the greatest act of compassion we've ever seen. And yet he did not teach anything until he understood what he had to teach. He didn't cloud himself with a distraction, now I want to go out and help others. Because he realized that he didn't know how to do that yet. And so he went out and sought enlightening first, awakening first, so that he could teach others. If the Buddha decided, if there was that type, that notion, and actually there was that notion, it was included in the Vedas, but if the Buddha acted on that notion that, okay, I really want to help people, but I'm not going to do anything until all of the beings are awakened, what would we have? Well, we wouldn't have Buddhism, would we? We wouldn't have this incredible teaching, because he would have consciously put it aside until he saw around him all awakened beings. Of course, even with his teachings, 2,600 years later, there's not all that many awakened beings, are there? Why is that? Because the First Noble Truth states that there is dukkha in the world. It's a noble truth, meaning it transcends time, and it transcends every type of teaching that would follow and that came before. It's a statement that as long as we have a human life, there's going to be disappointment, there's going to be unsatisfactory experiences, there's going to be birth, sickness, aging, and death. There's going to be suffering. That's part of living in the world. There's nothing we can do about that. And to create a practice over ending that is saying, well, that's not true. There's no such thing as the First Noble Truth. We can change that somehow. We can change it with just altruistic ideas. And then the Buddha states in the Second Noble Truth, it is individual craving and clinging that originates and perpetuates suffering. It's not because there's not enough bodhisattvas in the world, why the First Noble Truth, why dukkha occurs. It's from ignorance that dukkha occurs. And to do anything else that doesn't address ignorance, to empty ourselves of ignorance, is only going to continue suffering, no matter how altruistic or compassionate we might be. Is that clear? Mm-hmm. And I don't mean to go on a rant about the bodhisattva ideal. That's more metaphorical for most human beings. Most human beings care about other human beings. We're inherently compassionate. We want to help everyone. Everybody in the world, or just about everyone in the world who's not psychotic, would like to snap their fingers and bring peace to everyone, wouldn't we? But yet we can't do it. Why? Because we're ignorant of the way to achieve that. We're ignorant of Four Noble Truths. We haven't developed that understanding. We haven't emptied ourselves of ignorance. That's where right intention and right view in the entire Eightfold Path develop. Did you have something to say, or you just...
No, and you just touched it in that emptying ourselves of ignorance of Four Noble Truths is done through right intention, right effort, right mindfulness.
Yes, and that's... just got distracted. That's the reason why the Buddha taught an Eightfold Path. Again, if we could naturally do that, even if it was that if someone could just introduce the notion that most human beings are good and compassionate and loving, etc., be mindful of that. If that was all that we had to do, the Buddha would have stopped there. He would have said, just do this. Just be nice. There's this... most of you aren't old enough to remember a guy called Dr. Carlton Fredericks. The reason why I say that is he had a very early influence in my life because my mother used to listen to him on WOR radio. Yeah. And he was big on the power of positive thinking. He really was quite a visionary and a very interesting man, and I'm not diminishing what he said. Except that view was rooted in ignorance. I didn't realize it at the time. It contradicts the First Noble Truth. It's creating this mind state that if I can just be focused on what's positive in my life, somehow all the negative aspects of life will just fall away. And of course, the Buddha realized 2,600 years ago, you can't. There's suffering in life. If we're going to live in reality, we have to accept the fact that there's positive experiences, then there's negative experiences, and there's experiences that we just don't care about, neutral experiences. But to only focus on the positive qualities or try to create this idea of a utopic world, even to entertain the idea that a utopic world is possible at some point, which is kind of what the New Age philosophy is, that we're on this verge of this grand cosmic awakening where peace will prevail, denies the First Noble Truth. It's just not living in reality. And again, this was a difficult stand for the Buddha to take 2,600 years ago. And it's still difficult for people to accept today that we should look at life in reality rather than making believe that everything is wonderful. It's not, is it? And it never can be. But that's not a negative statement. That's not nihilistic and it's not pessimistic. It's simply realistic. And again, why did the Buddha start out his teaching by saying, you know what, life sucks? Because he's trying to hit us between the eyes saying, take a look at this. Even 2,600 years ago, there are people that wanted to walk around with their so-called head in the clouds saying everything is miserable, everything is wonderful, while the hair's on fire. It's not based in reality. And there is great power and great peace that comes from accepting life is going to be unsatisfactory at times. There's going to be disappointment. There's going to be sickness. There's going to be aging. There's going to be death. There's going to be times when I don't get what I feel I want. There's going to be times when I lose what I like to hold on to. That's all part of dukkha. And it's an accurate description of life, isn't it? Why did it take a human being to point that out to us? We all know it, right? We can accept those facts. But we don't want to face it. And we create an identity that is compulsively addicted to having only sensory input that is pleasurable and compulsively addicted to avoiding anything that might bring displeasure. And we spend our whole lives trying to create this bubble around our identity that this is what I want and this is what I need. Rather than accept and understand that life is an ongoing process rooted in birth, that from birth to death there's going to be unsatisfactory experiences. Learn to accept that and generate the right intention to not crave for anything to be different than it is or cling to identities that establish something that is contrary to reality. Is that clear?
Mm-hmm.
Good. Did a good job then. pop up. Being mindful of right intention to awaken with the understanding that, like the Buddha, an awakened human being can then assist others in ending suffering is noble engagement with the Dhamma. The Buddha did not send monks out to teach the Dhamma until they had awakened. Once awakened, teaching the Buddha's Dhamma was simply an expression of their own awakening. And that's important too. The Buddha had, after the first month of the Buddha's teachings, it said that he had over 1,000 monks now listening to him in that short month. But he didn't immediately start to try to spread the news, the good news of his religion, by sending these folks out. He very carefully developed their own understanding. And then when they awakened, some rather quickly, some it took a few years, some like Ananda, it was a month after he passed, 45 years later. But when they awakened, he then gave them instruction to go out and wander around northern India like he was doing and teach his Dhamma. But they had awakened first. In the Majjhima Nikaya, the Buddha teaches his son Rahula that in thought, word, and deed, one should be mindful of right intention. In thought, word, and deed, always be mindful of the consequences. Will the consequences be painful, or will they develop unbinding? If through mindfulness you know your thoughts, words, and deeds will lead to further confusion and suffering, you should abandon them. If through mindfulness you know that your thoughts, words, and deeds will develop peaceful consequences, develop unbinding, then you may continue. And this afternoon's talk is on the mindfulness of Bahia, which is a very similar theme. With a quality of mind of right intention, informing thoughts, words, and deeds, living within the framework of the Eightfold Path becomes possible and effective. In the Samyutta Nikaya, I'm referencing different suttas in this, simply to point out that this is a pervasive teaching throughout all the Pali Canon. In the Samyutta Nikaya, the Buddha succinctly teaches right intention as, the Buddha's words, being mindful of the right intention to recognize and renounce clinging, to remain free from ill will, and to remain harmless. This is right intention. Any of us can do that, right? Any of us can engage in the entire Eightfold Path because it's all just as simple and direct. My words. Right intention is emphasized throughout the Pali Canon and is the motivation for Dhamma practice. Without the cultivation of right intention, practice can easily be distracted and lose focus of the Buddha's stated goal of the Dhamma, to abandon clinging to all objects and views. Being mindful of right intention, holding in mind the strong resolve to abandon clinging, will directly develop the quality of mind of equanimity. With nothing attached to, there is nothing to afflict or agitate the mind. Unbound, one remains in peace and lasting happiness. So that's the end of the talk. Why don't we go around the room like we do it in a class, and I'd just like to hear what you have to say about this, and if you have any questions, or even any questions about the notion of emptiness and how the Eightfold Path is used to develop that emptiness. We'll start with Matt.
Thanks, John. Glad everybody made it today. It's nice to be here with you. What this sutta means to me or points out to me is again that when we recognize our own ignorance of Four Noble Truths, we've already started something. We've already started to develop a view. We've developed right view, in that we recognize that we're ignorant of Four Noble Truths. As soon as we've developed that right view, and we already are on the path towards emptying clinging, because right view is the first spoke in the wheel of the Eightfold Path. So the next one, automatically, the first step that we take into this recognition of ignorance of the Four Noble Truths is right intention, is the intention to abandon clinging and craving. The next step that we go into is then, you know, as we go, is right effort. And that effort to continue to keep the intention and keep that right view as we go through this Eightfold Path. All the way through to right mindfulness, which is maintaining or holding in mind the Eightfold Path that we're on, that we're in, that is right view in itself. So this sutta really, we don't need to wonder how am I gonna become not ignorant of Four Noble Truths. How am I going to figure this out? All we have to do is just put one foot in front of the other and continue on the Eightfold Path, and it's there. That's how we become mindful of Four Noble Truths, mindful of the Eightfold Path and how to continue and how to develop that mind of equanimity that is available through the practice.
That's just beautiful. I can't say it any better than that, but I will say it again. Right view is initially the intention, the right intention, to empty yourself of ignorance. That's the beginning of right view, and a profound right view is one that has actually accomplished that and has the experience of emptying yourself of that initial ignorance, of empty yourself of clinging. So we've been joined by a few folks. Is that the sisters?
Yes.
Oh, good. Come on in when you're ready. Glad you're here. Kevin, good to see you this morning.
Good to see you, John. Thanks for putting this retreat on. Nice to see everybody here, too. Not really sure I have anything to add. It's pretty clear to me, you know, moment by moment, you know, the sort of emptying of the views of self, and I've become more familiar with that, and I'm comfortable with it. I guess what I'm observing or noticing is that the world's not okay with it, because I'm going completely against, you know, people aren't, you know, I know what this, you know, I mean, I'm doing what Matt said, you know, foot in front of the other, and makes sense to me, but it's not making sense to anybody else, which, it's interesting, because, you know, people form this, you know, thing, whatever this identity that you form, you know, people think they know what should make you happy, or what you want, or, you know, where you are in your life. This is what you need, this is where you need to go, this is what you need to do. I mean, it's an interest, and their views are coming from ignorance, so I guess I'm okay with emptying. I see it every moment of my life. It's just, and I'm not hanging on or clinging to where that's going to lead or where I'll end up or whatever, but it's contradictory to you know, to everything that has brought me here, you know, my family, whatever, my friends, people that think they know me, but
hello, man.
When I'm emptying all that and releasing that, then what's there to know? It's like,
yeah. Hello, Helen.
I don't know if it makes any sense or not, but it's. I'm very comfortable and at peace and happier than I've ever been with following the Eightfold Path and emptying everything. And, you know, there's an initial sort of uncertainty and, you know, naturally you think, well, if I'm here and I'm always here emptying, you know, that's okay. That's what I want to do. That's where I want to be. And if it makes other people concerned for me or whatever else, then probably just have to be mindful of those associations. Probably won't be seeing those people or interacting with that part of the world, I guess. So, and that's okay. I'm at peace with that.
Yeah, that's all part of the Duke of the First Noble Truth and the inherent ignorance. You know, an understanding of Dukkha allows us to be at peace with what's occurring in the world without necessarily approving of it. You know, there's a lot of things that we don't approve of, but we accept it. Simply, it's part of that Dukkha. It's part of the competitive nature and the aggressive nature of an unawakened mind that is ignorant of Four Noble Truths. That's the result of it. But that's the great understanding that comes from it, too.
It could also be that you have an influence on those people around you, and they see your state of calm, that they might, you know, do the "I'll have what he's having."
Well, there's a reason why you didn't come this morning, because that's what we talked about.
You
didn't need to hear it. No, but you do, Helen. You have it in a great way that they're basically the talk. Got a little bit into the bodhisattva ideal and how that's not really an ideal goal. But the most powerful effect that we can have, I say it often in class here, the most loving thing I can do for myself and for everyone else on the planet is to take to the Dhamma and awaken and be an example. You think about what we think of the Buddha, it's usually sitting like that in peace. That's the greatest example of compassion too. He's not doing anything that's contributing to the harm of the world. And of course he did everything to alleviate suffering, those people that want to develop that Dhamma. It's the most loving thing we can do. Rather, and I'm not saying we shouldn't take up causes, but it's much more effective to develop awakening for yourself prior to take up some kind of social cause. And again, I'm not saying you shouldn't, but you're going to be much more effective at bringing peace to the world if you've developed peace in yourself first.
There's a saying that's been attributed to Al Franken. I may not be able to carpet the world, but I can wear slippers. So it's like, you know, start where you are.
Yeah, I don't know if Al Franken said that, but...
I Google it, that's what comes up, because I'm writing a related article about how you can heal the earth and your patch of the earth, and it has an effect.
Start with yourself. So, okay. Mary, Helen, what we talked about basically emptying yourself of ignorance. That was the morning talk. So, and whatever else you might have to share with us this morning.
Mm.
Happy birthday, by the way.
Oh, thank you. It's been
wonderful. And Liz, too, this week?
Yeah, now it's March 13th.
Well, happy birthday. We tend to spread it out.
Hey, why not?
It hasn't gone into April in a number of years.
Yeah, so this time's going to... auspicious.
She's nine.
Yeah.
She looked at the cake and was like, "Oh, no."
Just working on, you know, being that open, empty vessel, carrying less. I'm trying to worry about less things. So that's kind of what I'm working on.
Glad you made it.
Thank you.
This afternoon now. Mary, good to see you today.
Oh, it's good to be here. I'll pass.
Glad you're here. Kevin.
Good to be here. I was thinking about the teachings this week. How different they are. This one's the most accessible, I think, for me. Mm-hmm. Out of the others, I'm trying to figure why maybe the others were more difficult. And I think in the Dhamma, Buddha taught, really it was the same thing over and over to people at every level. I think he tried to find a level of the group you're speaking to.
Oh, yeah.
To make examples that would make sense in their life when he was living. And then when he was speaking to Ananda, I guess the first one,
yep.
Ananda, he was speaking to somebody who was this close to awakening, and I think that's why it was
It was so deep. He was able to speak to him in such a deep way, and that's maybe why it was difficult, more difficult to access. But this was much more accessible and understandable. And it's so difficult to have that mindfulness, you know, when you're, you know, just a beginner. I meditated this morning, and it seemed like my mind was very distracted. And then when I came here to meditate, it was very concentrated. Oh. So each time is different. And it's But I guess with continued practice, the concentration will be even more.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure it will. I'm glad you're here today. That first, the Kula Sanada Sutta, everybody that was here got it. It was an easy one, right? it was not an easy one to understand. The
talking about Tuesday?
Yeah.
Tuesday.
Yeah.
I fell off my pillow.
The theme was the same in this morning's talk and Thursday's and Saturday's talk, but much easier to understand. One of the reasons is the repetitiveness and the reference to unfamiliar terms, perception, non-perception, etc. But really what the Buddha was teaching in that sutta is the same as everything else, that these conceptual planes of consciousness that people would aspire to back then and even today, which is the modern application of emptiness, not the way the Buddha taught emptiness, what the Buddha was saying is there's no value in that. He first started that sutta with saying, release yourself from clinging to your local environment, to the objects around you. I think he used cattle and gold and silver, etc. And then he said, empty yourself of clinging to the earth, to the physical environment in general. The next step was empty yourself from connection to the cosmos as a place to create an identity. Then he took it to those conceptual levels of perception, non-perception, treating them as just as temporary objects as gold, silver, and cattle. These conceptual planes of consciousness that we create in our imagination and then choose to aspire to them, they should be recognized as completely useless too as far as creating an identity. And again, using a very long sutta and a very repetitive sutta to just say, let go of all those silly views too. And the reason why he pointed it out to Ananda, it was just as common in the Buddha's time as it is in modern time to create conceptual applications of the Dhamma rather than practical applications of the Dhamma. And most of modern Buddhism is based on that conceptual ideal of emptiness rather than a practical way of developing awakening or full human maturity. So that's where that came from. And I'm going to stop apologizing for teaching it now. Robin, it's good to see you.
Emptiness talk is sort of helping me understand my own like doubt of everything. Starting to realize that I don't, with this practice, I don't really have to believe in anything, which is good because it's hard for me to, because I'm a doubter. But it's kind of, I realize maybe that's not a bad thing because I don't have to let go of maybe something that other people might have to let go of.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's a great understanding in and of itself, that there's nothing the Buddha taught that has to be taken on faith. And there's many people that would argue with me. In fact, I do get in arguments with a few other teachers. The Eightfold Path is completely experiential, and we experience that directly. You don't have to take, you don't have to believe that there's such a thing as right view. You develop it for yourself. You have the experience of right view. You don't have to believe that there's such a thing as the other factors of the Eightfold Path. You develop them directly. Again, there's nothing the Buddha ever taught to take on faith, but it relates back to that Kula Sanada Sutta, our favorite sutta. Those other conceptual mind states that were taught back then and still today as something to achieve, you have to take on faith, can't you? Because you cannot have an experience of neither perception nor non-perception. It doesn't even make any sense. But yet those are taught, and they're still being taught today. The Buddha said none of that. You don't have to take a word that I'm saying on faith. But you can develop it directly.
Yeah, he taught a method, not a religion.
Yes, boy, that's a better way of saying it. I'll remember that, so I won't get into these long, elaborate explanations. He taught a method.
The student teaches the teacher.
Yes, thank you, Helen.
Not usually.
Lorna, good to see you today.
Thank you. Good to meet you. Well, following on from what I said yesterday, class, that you know, I'm beginning to see in my day-to-day life the Buddha's teachings reflecting back onto me. Mm. And I can see things. That can come in all forms, you know, through all your senses or whatever. It could be a smell or something, you know. Okay. And I was thinking, you know, if you have a smell that you don't like, or anything, you can just have that trigger in your mind. You go, oh, you know, that's part of the stress in life, you know, just coming up against something that you don't like, or it's distasteful, or it's, you know. And you can also kind of like smile at the moment. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not that if I had a major thing wrong with me, I was just like, okay, you know. Yeah, I don't think I was that. But just that as you go through day to day, you can almost, you know, when things don't go your way, somebody slips in a parking space before you or something like that, you know, you say, oh, you know, that would have like stressed me and the silly fool and all that. You'd have gone down that road. But now, you know, you can just say, oh, you know, that's part of stress in life, this will happen. And you can just sort of almost smile at the moment.
Yeah, and maintain a peaceful and calm mind. Even when
can I just ask one question about meditation, actually? As your little intro to the meditation, you were talking about, and you and Matt were talking about the expanding and closing and expanding and closing, which is the formation of life almost, you know, the breathing or the this sort of movement.
Yep.
Is always happening. I know we're not supposed to think of things in meditation, but you have to lay something in your mind for you to think about. Just lay it softly in your mind. So this opening and closing with your breathing that you look at when you're meditating, that would be you would say an insightful way of keeping your mind on your breathing. Because not only is it the breathing that you're looking at, but it's the life in the bigger picture.
Yeah.
That life is throbbing is the wrong word, but movement. Like that, the seasons, and, you know, whatever.
You just
beware that life is opening and closing, as well as your breathing, as well as your chest, and so forth.
That's incredibly insightful, Lorna. The reason why the breath is so useful as an object of developing concentration is it's a perfect expression and metaphor for all of life. The expansion of an in-breath and the contraction of the out-breath is an expression of ongoing life throughout the universe. From the microcosmic to from the smallest cell, the Buddha would use the word kalapa, to the entire universe, everything does that. Everything. And so we're directly, and I'm careful right now about not saying we become interconnected, because you know that can be a very confusing teaching. But without any effort on our part, we are physically connected with everything. But again, that's not a Dhamma teaching. There's no useful teaching. That is not a teaching on dependent origination. It's just a simple fact. It's like saying, I think I used the Saturday, most apples are red, some aren't. It's a statement of truth, but it's not a Dhamma practice. The fact that we are connected in that way through the elements that make us up and through the internal action of the universe is simply a fact. And when we use Qigong from a good teacher, or we engage in a meditation practice the way it's meant to be, we're coming in contact with reality rather than avoiding contact because of the views we've created that are based in ignorance. So thank you for that. Very insightful.
Thank you for that.
Yeah, I was going to say, and I apologize for going on and on and on about what you said, because you said it much simpler than I did. Thank you. Liz, it's good to see you this morning.
Good to see you. I'm glad you could make it. And just on that same note, it's being, and I don't know, it just came to me, and so I haven't formulated a way to articulate it, but it's being okay with the impermanence of things, because you're watching things go by moment to moment, the breath coming in, the breath coming out, the idea of the universe expansion, any of that is being okay with the impermanence of life itself. You know, it's not a very calm level. And like you said, it doesn't mean that when something impacts your life in a more difficult way or a more substantial way that you're going to necessarily be able to sit calmly and breathe through it, but it's a start, you know, mm-hmm. of being able to handle things more reasonably. I mean, we in our family are dealing with, you know, some important circumstances of impermanence, and I think even just the three of us are handling it in a way where it's just so much more understanding and more reason in, you know, how we're handling things in a much calmer way and a more skillful way.
Yeah, well, that's the right word, a more skillful way. The, I'm sorry, were you...
No, I have another question, but if you wanted to say something.
You'll remember the question?
I will.
Good. You touch on something that is often misunderstood, that the Buddha is not teaching that we should never have a so-called negative feeling, meaning we should never be sad or fearful or upset or anything like that. When it's appropriate to feel sadness, we feel sadness. In other words, we were talking about a lot of people I happen to know right now have loved ones that are coming up on death. You know, a lot of, you know, it just seems like there's a lot of people that I know. The teachings don't say, well, I shouldn't feel anything about that, or I should maybe feel happy about it. We gain the understanding that we should feel appropriate to what's occurring, rather than need it to be any difference. That's the problem. When we feel sad and say I shouldn't feel sad, or we start blaming a situation for what we're feeling. So in other words, the Buddha taught just the opposite of escapism or avoidance. He taught how to be fully mindfully present with whatever's occurring, including intense grief, if that's what it is, including intense fear, but to keep it in context of what's occurring and relate it back to Four Noble Truths. So if we're upset about the impending, I mean, I can talk about this too, but my dad's 99 years old. There was quite a long period of time, starting when he was 80, that every time one of my brothers or sister called, I thought, oh, this is the call. Mm-hmm. I finally got through that, you know, so, but it could be. The call could come right now. And when the call comes, I can tell you, I'm going to probably be in tears for a long time. I'm going to be sad. I'm going to be upset. I'm going to be distracted. And all of those will be appropriate feelings. I'll get into trouble if I say I shouldn't feel that way. Or start blaming some cosmic system that, you know, my dad can't live to 140 as opposed to other people that die at 10. It's just based in reality. And my expression and my feeling and my thoughts are appropriate to what's occurring. They don't need to be any different than they are. And that's the essence of a peaceful and calm mind. So you've heard me say often that you can be at peace with a less than peaceful mind state. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm referring to. Mm-hmm. your mind state might be in great agitation, but you can be at peace with that agitation because it's appropriate for what's occurring. That's what that means. That's what awakening means. That's what a fully mature human being means. We're thinking and feeling what's appropriate to the situation. We're not trying to escape the world. We're not trying to find a way to deal with it. We're trying to find a way. We're not trying to. We can develop a way to live fully, mindfully present with what's occurring in our life, no matter what it is. So again, thank you, Liz, for pointing that out.
The other question I had was, can you tell me again the name of Come See For Yourself?
Ehepasico.
Ehepasico.
Yeah. There's an article on the website, too, that gets into that. But something the Buddha used repeatedly, that word, Ehepasico, meaning come and see for yourself, which he always says that after teaching some portion of the Dhamma. So he's referring to, I've given you this teaching, now it's up to you to have the experience of it. Come and see for yourself. And again, he keep reinforcing the experiential nature of the Dhamma rather than to take it on faith alone. If he was intending to start a faith-based religion, he would give some grand cosmic teaching and say, there you go. But he didn't. He said, this is reality. Now do this and you can see it for yourself. Ehepasico. So thank you for bringing that up. That's such an important thing. Bonnie, good to see you.
Good to see you. So I think for me this week, the idea how you talked about emptiness in relationship, because it can mean so many things, that metaphor of emptiness, we talked about the empty bowl the week before.
Yep.
People say, I'm so empty, and we think, well, that's an opportunity then for you to choose what you want to put inside. You have a choice. But in talking about a relationship to the Dhamma is the idea of emptying yourself of ignorance. Made it like very clear because that's what becomes the obstacle to not seeing, not having a good intention, wrong speech, I think, because it's about, opening up to possibilities of wisdom that's there if you allow yourself to see the truth about what you don't want to see.
Yeah.
So, or what you need to learn to do. So that kernel to me just sits right on top of the value of the Eightfold Path. That was really very
enlightening.
Okay. trying to think about all the concepts and I got that on Tuesday when, it was like, what? But that was the significant thing that I took away from the whole discussion. And so it's valuable.
Thank you for saying that, Bonnie. If we get caught up in the Kula Sanatta Sutta and all the discursiveness in that, we miss the point. But if we realize that all that the Buddha's teaching there is to let go of these ridiculous views that we create, and you'll live in peace. That's the point. That's the point of the Eightfold Path.
And then something that you had said about, if he speaks to different people, I think, at different levels, we walk away with what we need to walk away with. So when we get this piece, I get this piece, I get this, that's okay. And then also to be, at peace with yourself, for that's what I can carry away with today.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, and what Kevin said about the Buddha had this incredible ability. He was often seen as being clairvoyant or a mind reader because he always knew the right thing to say, but he wasn't. He was just incredibly mindfully present, and he could because of that. And I think we've all experienced that. As we've deepened our mindfulness, we realize that we're more understanding of other people. We know what they're going through. One of the best examples of that is the Fire Discourse, which will be part of the retreat, the third discourse the Buddha ever gave. is called the Fire Discourse, and it was given to a group of fire worshippers, what was common at the time. And he used the understanding of who they were in a metaphorical way to use that fire worshipping as a way of worshipping the passions of their own fire inside. And he directly taught that it is those passions that are creating dukkha in your life. Recognize the passions, diminish the passions, and you'll live a peaceful and calm life. He spoke directly to what, in a way that those people could understand. It so happened that it became a very useful teaching for everyone. But when you read the Pali Canon and read the suttas, you see the situational application of his teachings. I gave 3.5 teachings and another teaching Tuesday, by the way, on emptiness this week. They're all based on that same theme, but they all touch different aspects of the Dhamma. You know, the one on Tuesday, the Fena Sutta, relates emptiness directly to the five clinging aggregates. You know, but again, it's in that situational context. So thank you,
John. You're teaching so much of this, you might eventually get it.
that's what I'm craving for. I can tell you that when I first started teaching meditation, I guess maybe 8 years ago now, just across the street, I had a pretty good understanding of the Dhamma. But I remember thinking about this, that if I'm teaching this, I better know how to teach it. And that got me looking at how did the Buddha actually teach it. And then obviously all the writing and thinking about how to do this is such an incredible, has developed a deeper level of understanding in me that I didn't know was there. So again, when I thank you all, I really mean it. You know, thank you, because it's because of that.
And probably hearing our questions helps you to understand how we're learning it or not learning it, so that you can be a better teacher.
Exactly. I take a lot of what I hear in here, that guides what I'll be teaching next, and even how I present things. And that's true of even online students. Even the book, The Truth of Happiness, I put one revision in based on feedback from students. I'm in the middle of another revision based on that too. And so it's so helpful to me to understand that. This is the true meaning of a Sangha. You know, it's not just me sitting up here and, you know, blathering this stuff out. It's us developing the Dhamma together. And I know that the Buddha felt the same way. Now, here's an awakened human being before he started his Sangha. But he always, you can tell by the words how much he got out of that interaction, whether it was just one-on-one with someone or being a part of this amazing thing that he started. You know, and we're all part of it. We contribute to each other. Just, I mean, it kind of blows me away how every class, I could never say that we've had a class here that was just a waste of time. It's never happened. But I've been at plenty of places, and I'm not just talking about other Buddhist places. I've been at plenty of places that there was a lot of importance placed on what was going on, but it was really just a waste of time. It never happens here. And it's not just because you have the greatest teacher in the world. It's because you all have taken to the Dhamma, and you can express it in a way that's helpful for all of us. And that really is remarkable. I've been around this game for a long time. And honestly, I've never seen it in such an effective way as what's developed here in Frenchtown. It really is remarkable.
Well,
okay.
And I'll just quickly say that as somebody who listens to it more than I can get here, it's so helpful to hear. I'll be like, okay, great, Jen's going to say something.
Yeah.
Because she says a lot of things that are on my mind, you know.
Yeah.
Or Lord, you know, or Lord, or, you know, everybody. I'll hear something from everybody, and it's so helpful. So even after I listen to you, I never don't listen to the rest of the class. Because I want to hear what everybody says. Even if it's like sometimes I'm someplace where I can barely hear what's being said, I'm like, I'll go and find a place I didn't hear what Bonnie said. It's so helpful.
It is. And I get that online too from my online students or people that are just listening to the stuff that they get so much out of listening to what the Sangha has to say. Mm-hmm. They feel it. And I got people from Sweden and Italy and on the West Coast that say they feel like they're a part of our Sangha. Because they really are. They're listening to what you have to say and your insights and how you're developing. And it's so helpful. Literally, you know, it's not that there's millions of people, but literally across the world, we're having an impact on people.
know, it's just remarkable. And then, just to take my speech a little bit further, it all started with one guy who had the determination to figure it out and then had the guts to go out and teach it. You know? That's remarkable to me, that teaching is still available in its pure form. It's still being presented right here in this room, and we're still having the same experience that Kandana and Dhammadina and Ananda and all of them had, by listening and experiencing a Dhamma, by putting it into practice. It really is remarkable. Thank you all for just kind of bringing that up and going there. So we'll have a little potluck. I started this morning talking about what this is. You know, a retreat is taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. And also the reason why I don't run silent retreats. One thing the Buddha didn't, but if you're in silence, you cannot experience the effects of right speech. So while we're socializing, be mindful of right speech and engage in right speech and use this as an opportunity, just like my residential retreats are, an opportunity to be fully immersed in the Eightfold Path and so to be fully mindful of right speech and right action. It's okay to not say something if you don't have something that's really useful to say. It's okay to be mindful that your speech should be harmless. It should actually contribute to something. On retreat, we have the only time we are silent is during our meals. And it really is a remarkable, most people have a remarkable experience during that because they never do. If you think about how most people eat, it's also a social occasion. One of my things I'm still craving for is that restaurants would be just a little bit quieter, especially when I'm there. But you notice how restaurants, they seem to get louder and louder and louder as people enjoy their meals. And it's because of that. So we can have a nice, peaceful, quiet lunch. We don't have to take it in silence. But let's be mindful of right speech and practice the Eightfold Path. And then we have something to get very excited about afterwards. Bonnie's going to put on a show for us.
No, I'm not going to put on a show.
What?
No, I'm not going to put on a show. I need a few people to help Great. Share something.
That
so it's not a show.
It's yes, it's not a show. It's yeah. Okay. Can I call it a mindful experience?
Okay. Yes. Absolutely.
Bonnie's going to guide us in a mindful experience.
A mindful experience.
Yeah, and then
mindful experience.
Matt's going to lead us in Qigong, and then we'll have another afternoon sit and a talk on the mindfulness of Bahia, and then we'll finish our day.
Thank you for listening. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for guided meditations and instruction, and Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos. We rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Please feel free to contact me through crossrivermeditation.com. Peace.